Welcome to Songcraft. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. You're listening to Celebrants, co-written and recorded by our guests on this episode of Songcraft, Chris Thiele, Sarah Watkins, and Sean Watkins, collectively known as Nickel Creek. It's more than good to see you. It might be the cure, the opportunity to be who we played like we were. Grammy Award-winning trio Nickel Creek, mandolinist Chris Thiele, violinist Sarah Watkins, and guitarist Sean Watkins, formed a group as young children in Southern California and honed their chops on the bluegrass circuit for a decade before signing with Sugar Hill Records. Their platinum-selling debut self-titled album was produced by Alison Krauss in 2000 and revolutionized bluegrass and folk music, helping usher in a new era of what we now know as Americana. The genre-bending group has earned 9 Grammy nominations across categories in bluegrass, country, folk, contemporary folk, Americana, and American roots. Each member of Nickel Creek has taken part in a number of outside projects over the years. Thiele is a 2012 recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship and served as the host of the radio show Live From Here, formerly known as Prairie Home Companion, from 2016 to 2020. He has also released collaborative albums with world-renowned musicians, as well as 6 studio albums with his Grammy-winning band, Punch Brothers. Sean Watkins is a co-founder of Watkins Family Hour alongside Sarah, which has released 3 albums and maintains a long-running collaborative show in Los Angeles. Sean has also released a string of solo albums, while Sarah's extracurricular projects include the aforementioned Watkins Family Hour, as well as the Grammy-winning roots trio, I'm With Her. Sarah has released 4 studio albums and has contributed fiddle to recordings by artists such as Phoebe Bridgers, The Killers, and John Mayer. The Grammy-nominated Celebrants, Nickel Creek's 5th studio album and first project in 9 years, was recorded at Nashville's historic RCA Studio A and released to overwhelming critical acclaim in 2023.
Part 1.
Hey Songcraft listeners, today's episode, like so many others, is brought to you by Pearl Snap Studios.
Go to pearlsnapstudios.com and find out what they can do for your song. No matter what genre you write in, they can help you make a demo or fully produced record that you will be absolutely proud to share with friends, family, or even pitch to professional artists.
Dozens of Songcraft listeners before you have taken advantage of their services and have been more than pleased. We've given you some of the testimonials on air. I'm sure we'll do it again. But find out what they can do for you.
Hit up our friend Justin and his team at pearlsnapstudios.com. Tell them that Songcraft sent you and you'll get a discount on your first recording.
So, Scott, today we're going to be talking to Nickel Creek.
I heard that.
Yeah. And, you know, this group, I think, has a bit of a distinction amongst the people that we've talked to. Because we talk to songwriters, obviously. People know that, right?
I hope so.
Songwriters are not always the most proficient at their instruments. I mean, right? I know myself when people ask me, hey, can you play guitar? And I say, well, I play like a writer.
Yeah.
You know, I can get a song across. But when you're talking about, you know, some of the greatest instrumentalists of all time, they're often just known for being instrumentalists, not so much for being great songwriters as well.
Right.
But when we're talking to Nickel Creek, we're talking to people that know how to write a song,
yep,
know how to put a record together, an album together. But man, can they play.
Yeah, there's very few musicians that come to mind when I just think jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
And they're one of those bands that I've had that experience of watching play, and then you just kind of start laughing. Like, there's almost no other response to just the virtuosity.
Yeah. Well, I get kind of freaked out because then I go back and look at my guitar and say, is that what this is for? Like, is that, that's right, what I'm supposed to maybe be able to do on this thing?
Right,
because
right.
No.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we've had people on the show like Marty Stewart or Vince,
yeah,
Gill,
yeah,
or John Jorgensen, who are just
incredible,
unbelievable
guitarists,
musicians. But this is the first time we've had like 3 all at the same time. I don't think we've had an interview before that was me and you and 3 guests, 5 people in the mix.
Yeah.
We were outnumbered in terms of just instrumental intimidation.
I think if you add up their instrumental fortitude, you know, basically to the power of 3, then,
right,
then you'd have to say this is the most virtuosity we've ever had on the podcast.
Right. Yeah, I would say probably so. And the thing that's interesting to me about Nickel Creek is the way that you can't really pigeonhole them.
Right.
You can't necessarily call them a bluegrass band. Like, they started firmly in bluegrass and they're deeply rooted in the bluegrass tradition. But you could say, like, this is a bluegrass group. This is a pop group. This is an Americana group. This is there's jazz influences,
yeah,
here. It's almost like they have taken
all these different pieces of American music and made this amalgam that is uniquely Nickel Creek. And, yeah. you know, there's just something about them as a group that is incredibly appealing to me because it is like virtuoso playing,
yeah.
but it's also accessible. You know, there's, right. there's certain, you know, I think when we're in high school, we all go through phases where we get into certain groups. I'm not going to name any names, but you know, where the virtuosity exists only just to make people go, wow.
Wow.
And it's almost too clean and it lacks like yeah. any sort of soul or anything. And this is one of those groups that they just make you go, wow, but it's also soulful, it's tasteful, yeah. it's engaging. It's not just sort of, you know, virtuosity for its own sake.
Right.
It's truly engaging. It's entertaining. It's accessible. It's fun. It's all the things that I think good music's supposed to be.
Well, and I think if you look at someone purely as an instrumentalist, you think, oh, they're pushing the boundaries, meaning they can play faster now.
Right.
And I listened to this most recent Nickel Creek project, and they're pushing the bounds in terms of chord structure.
Yeah.
They're pushing the boundaries in terms of song construction. You know, so you know, I look at it, you know, the same way I look at a band like Radiohead sometimes, or what Prince would do, where right. you're actually pushing the bounds of creativity in the way you're writing the songs and putting them together.
Yeah.
It's not just about flying fingers. And who would you say, as a fan, I mean, who's the best instrumentalist that you've been a huge fan of?
I mean, I mentioned John Jorgensen a while ago, and he's done so many different things, but specifically his gypsy jazz
yeah.
stuff. To me, that stuff is just lives in its own category. When I watch his gypsy jazz band play, I'm just like, I have to close my jaw physically.
Yeah. I'm an unashamed Rush fan.
Yeah.
Like, I will happily listen to those drum parts and the way those, you know, that, to me, they're great songs, too. But I like anytime you can get that kind of virtuosity on the radio and put it together with hooks, I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. There's something about, you know, a band where, you know, listen, and this is controversial, but you know, there's certain people where you go, okay, the guy from Blues Traveler is an amazing harmonica player, right? Jimi Hendrix, amazing guitar player. I don't need to be reminded of it on every single
right.
song, you
right.
know, and there's something about great musicians that makes them even greater when they show restraint and when they
right.
show like their taste. And this is an example of a band that I think does that. They know when to show off and
right.
they know when to pull back and they know how to pace an album and pace a show. You know, and just thinking about all of the sort of idea of boundary blurring, a little over a week ago, Beyonce put out a record that's a country record. She says it's a Beyonce record.
Right.
It's been sort of touted as a country record. Dolly Parton is on it. Willie Nelson is on it. Post Malone is on it. He's very country. but it is a boundary blurring record in a lot of ways. She is very much embracing country music roots. And to some people, the idea of Beyonce making a country album makes them very angry.
Yeah.
And then other people, the idea of anyone not loving Beyonce's album makes them very angry.
Right.
And if social media is any barometer, whatever you think of the Beyonce country album tells the world everything that they need to know
right.
about you as a human being. And I say this to someone who's only heard a couple of songs so far, which I liked. But I haven't delved into the album yet. And I plan to. I think it's very interesting. I will say that the thing that I think is super cool about it is there's a very obscure, pioneering black female country artist named Linda Martell. And anybody who knows me knows I'm a bit of a champion of this guy, Howdy Glenn, who
yeah.
was a pioneering black country artist in the 70s who kind of slipped into obscurity. Linda Martell is very similar. She's largely slipped into obscurity amongst the general public. I think, you know, hardcore kind of country nerds know about her, but she's not a name that's widely known. And she is name-checked, and her voice appears on this Beyonce record, which that I think
that's
is
cool.
something that's very cool, that somebody who has a platform. Beyonce is one of the most, forget like musical artists, she's one of the most famous human beings on the planet. To have her use her platform to say, hey, everybody, look at this artist who didn't get their due and let me
right.
shine a spotlight. I think that is really cool. And that gets into one of those things where you kind of go, well, who cares if Beyonce, is she considered country? Is she considered pop? Is she considered R&B? who cares what she's considered,
right?
As long as she's kind of elevating good music and bringing good music to people's attention. I think that's a good thing.
Well, a good record is a good record. Now, I will say something that may be unpopular is that I'm a fan of genre.
Okay.
So, right.
I like to stay in my box.
Let me expand upon this a bit. Sometimes we'll talk to people and we'll talk about this idea of the fact that genres are kind of blurring away. Uh-huh. Like this idea of these well-defined lines between styles are not something that we have to adhere to anymore. And I get that. And I understand that. I like projects that push genre. But if we don't have genre, nothing pushes anything anymore.
Right.
You almost have to have genre to have an album be groundbreaking.
Yeah.
And you have to have boundaries to have them be sort of broken and pushed.
Right.
And I sometimes wonder, are we going to have just an amorphous mass of music out there?
Yeah.
Which doesn't really bear any distinction from each other.
Right.
So I do sometimes get in there and I can get a little cranky about records if I don't feel like they adhere to, you know, close enough to a genre. But when something is actively pushing, you know, and it's doing it on purpose and there's a reason for it, then I can kind of be more in on it. But I am a fan of genre.
Yeah. Okay.
What genre are you a fan of? I just genre.
My genre is genres.
Yeah.
You know, what's funny is I recently met someone over in London. We were talking about this last episode that I had been traveling and she was telling me about her band. I said, what kind of music do you play? And I said, I'm going to stop you right there. I dare you to just name a genre. Because if you ever ask anybody, like, what type of music you make, everybody goes, well, kind of a sort of rootsy kind of rock, techno, pop synth thing, but it's got more of kind of folk undertones.
Like if Tom Petty and Dua Lipa had a baby.
Like, nobody ever just goes, it's a rock band.
Right,
I definitely recognize that genre blending and genre pushing sort of becomes meaningless if there's no genre. But I do like the idea of a Beyonce saying, I'm going to make a country record, or a Taylor Swift saying, I'm going to make a pop record, or, you know, even like Sinatra would do, like, I'm doing a big band album.
Right.
Or, no, I'm doing this sort of, you know. So I think there's like, there's something about the intentionality of it. But yeah, I think your point is well made that we need genres in order to push genres or even blend genres.
But I would say 8 to 9 times out of 10, artists that feel like they're pushing the bounds of genre really aren't.
Right. Right.
Oh, it's not straight country. Yes, it is.
Right. Well, there's something to be said for becoming a master of a genre and then pushing it. Like, I look at a band like Nickel Creek that we're talking to today. They started in bluegrass, and there gets to be a point where it's like, these guys can do anything that can be done
on an instrument,
bluegrass, you know. And so if they're going to continue to advance, they're going to have to absorb other influences. I've been on a big Ricky Skaggs kick lately, and I have to admit, I was never a big Ricky Skaggs fan back in the day, and a lot of that had to do with image. You know, he just kind of had the mullet and the mustache, and I was kind of like, this is kind of cheese ball, you know. I sort of dismissed it. I started listening to him recently, and it's that perfect mix of acoustic and electric instruments, and I thought, you know, there's a guy who's pushing the boundaries of bluegrass, he's pushing the boundaries of country, but it's because he is completely proficient in those things.
Right.
So he can do that. So I've become a late in life Ricky Skaggs convert, and I would encourage everyone to go on YouTube, watch the video of the song Country Boy, for nothing else but to see Bill Monroe buck dancing in a New York subway. Worth the price of admission.
I'm just a little taken aback by you just referred to yourself as late in life. I'm like, what does that say about me? You're a last minute convert.
Right. You know, just before the priest comes to read the last rites, I have just said, I believe in Ricky Skaggs.
Yeah.
Anyway, all that to say, Nickel Creek's a great group and a great bunch of people. And we had fun. This was a bit like herding cats to have 5 people, you know, on one interview. And you and I weren't even in the same place. So we were on Zoom, and all 5 of us were in different locations, and it was wild. So we have, hold on to your hats, folks, because
it's a party.
this is going to be a good one. So with no further ado, Nickel Creek.
Part 2.
Chris, Sarah, Sean, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Happy to be here.
It's great to speak with you guys. We love on this show to kind of dig into the backgrounds of our guests and find out kind of early influences and that sort of thing. But and we're going to do that. But I don't want to start there this time like we normally do. I actually want to start with your most recent record, Celebrants. This is an album that is a little different for you guys in that every single song is co-written by the three of you and your collaborator, Mike Elizondo. You haven't had an album before where every single song was a three-way co-write, or even an album where every single song was an original song. So it's a bit different in that sense. And I also understand that in terms of how it was written, it was a very intentional process of getting together in person with the express knowledge of, hey, we are writing our next record. I'd love to just get some insight into that process, what that was like for you guys, and that experience of coming together in maybe what was kind of a different way for Nickel Creek than what you've done before.
Setting the scene, you know, it was February of 2021 and our calendars were wiped clean. And we had sort of had the spark to do some more writing and recording earlier in the pandemic year. And that ended up coming together in a month of writing in Los Angeles, or in Santa Barbara in Los Angeles. Chris's family came out from New York, and we spent the first 2 weeks at a friend's house with our families together, just, you know, potting up and reuniting and seeing each other as parents for the first time, seeing each other and being with people for the first time. So we were very happy to be together. And we didn't come with you know, the opposite of Dotted Line, where we came with as big of chunks, of song chunks as possible. This time we came with little bits, and, you know, like a chorus chunk, or like an idea of a topic or a little riff. And we had all of those things to sort of share with each other. But we spent a lot of time the first couple of days just talking about what kind of record we wanted to make, what we were excited about. One of the first things that really lit us up was talking about the Smile Sessions and what a beautiful adventure that was, the unfinished Smile Sessions. And we often talk about how one of the most exciting parts about that is how it's unfinishedness, you get to really get inside these little themes and think about, like, oh, what would have been, what was he going for? What was the intent, or where might it have gone? And we wanted to write an album that felt related to itself as much as possible, rather than a collection of individual songs. And so we started putting these pieces together and just seeing what we had, and then allowing them to relate to each other. It was a completely different process for us as a band.
Yeah, that was really the first night we sat down, and we was just like, what do we want to do? You know, it's like, we knew we wanted to take a big swing and do something ambitious, but what does that look like? What does it sound like? How many songs? What kind of songs? What are the lyrics? What's the lyrical content about? It was all at, you know, TBD. And and so that, you know, the first really big thought that we had was, like Sarah said, was just something, you know, trying to do our version of what Brian Wilson was doing with that album. And and, you know, what the discovery process of what that might be for us was the writing process, and just, you know, just starting with, you know, something. And then, you know, after a few days, you start to see songs sort of emerge, and maybe a few starts, and then you start to see how they relate to each other. But yeah, that was really the instigator was just thinking about the scope of that album, or what that album was going to be. And like Sarah said, the unfinishedness of it was really exciting, and just kind of pointed us in a direction.
Yeah.
You know, not sonically, but just Yeah, in terms of thinking larger than your typical album thought process is.
Larger than our typical.
Than that we'd ever done, yeah.
It's interesting that you guys would bring up the Smile Sessions because I thought about Brian Wilson as I was listening to the new record.
And oh, cool.
It seems that you guys kind of have an advantage, you know, compared to Brian, where Brian had bandmates that were going, what the hell are you doing? And, you know, while he's trying to push the boundaries and he's trying to change things and move forward, that he, you know, he almost had to do that kind of on an island. But you guys seem really united in this pursuit of change and pursuit of kind of bending genres. Talk a little bit about that and just like finding common ground on wanting to move out and do some things that are not necessarily safe for you as a band.
I think that at this point in the band's life, you know, we're 34 years in to Nickel Creek. And I think that one of the reasons we're still here is that we've evolved as human beings from people that are more interested in what we have to say and using a band to sort of serve as an amplifier for like our individual voices. We've evolved from that, point of perspective to the perspective of like, I'm still here because I'm interested in what Sean and Sarah have to say. And so if we start thinking about a topic, you know, and for Celebrants, say the overarching topic is togetherness, then I really love hearing what they have to say. I love observing their lives, that hearing the stories that they have to tell when we start thinking about these things. What kind of stories do you have about togetherness, whether it's with a stranger or you know, a partner, a child, you know, it's I mean, one's own child, not just a random child. and then reflect on their reflections and see what it is. And I think an interesting, to circle back to the first question, a thing that sets this album apart in the context of our records, at least, is that we weren't like writing one song and then moving on to another song. It was, we were writing the record. And so all of the songs have the benefit of their relationship with all of the songs. And so, you know, you're not just finishing things and then finishing more things and finishing more things and then seeing what goes together. You're writing everything to go together right from the start. And so, you know, that you don't have to say everything in one, you know, we're going to tackle togetherness, you know, this aspect of the togetherness in this song. And that might brush up against an interesting thought that we can actually just stick a pin in and deal with in another song later. And potentially use, you know, or maybe a theme arises and just a musical theme of some kind arises. Like this little mandola instrumental in the middle of the song, holding pattern, dung gong 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 gong. That's fun, and it's just a little riff in that song, and then it becomes the chorus in To the Airport.
Drops her off next to a childless man of business whose cares are few.
And then it becomes the refrain of Water Under the Bridge Part 2. And that's the kind of thing that's very, very difficult to do if you're working in a really modular way. Like, here's a song that I think is for this record, and here's another song that I think is for this record.
And then, you know, you step back at the end of that process and see what goes. And, you know, and often you're leaving good material on the cutting room floor because it doesn't go, because it wasn't actually meant, you know, they weren't actually written with each other in mind. So this project was very, very different for us in that regard specifically.
Yeah. The analogy I always make is that, like, you were building 18 houses at the same time, of varying size and shape, but starting at, you know, at the base level, like foundationally what they are, and then, you know,
yeah,
and then adding stuff to them. And then as we added something to one house, you know, we were like, oh, this would be cool on this house over here too. And like Chris was saying, if you're working modularly, it's really tough to go back and put that stuff in, and it would be like forcing that to happen. Mm-hmm. But if by starting song, by having them all kind of start and go up together at the same time, you're able to borrow from each other,
yeah,
and have it kind of sound natural. I think if you did it the other way, it would sound forced, because it is forced.
I'm curious if you guys, I know this certainly was not the agenda or guiding principle in any way when you first got together, but I'm curious now that this body of work has been written and recorded and exists, as you look on it now, would you go so far as to call it a concept album?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, that's sort of the term turns some people off, but I feel like I would like every album to be conceptual in some way that I work on, you know,
right,
not haphazard.
Thing is, albums are not our, you know, our society's preferred delivery system of new music. You need to have a reason to put those songs together and release them all at once. In my opinion, it's like, what's the damn point?
Yeah.
Like, just put a song out. If it's not related to the other songs, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Just put it out. It's easier. That's how people listen anyway.
Right.
You know, like people want to play, like people listen to stuff on a playlist. They don't listen on a record. So if you're making a record, you better do it with intention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Some of my favorite albums, they feel that way, whether or not the artist was thinking that way or not. You know, you feel like this album is a snapshot of a place and a time and subject matter. It's just cohesiveness is really all it is. It's like you want an album to be cohesive, and there's there are various ways of doing that, you know?
Yeah.
And for us, it was, you know, figuring out what we wanted, you know, kind of setting a mission statement at the beginning, which was, you know, the inherent friction in any meaningful relationship and leaning into it,
mm-hmm,
and togetherness. And that's really, once you kind of do that and you sort of set up a, not boundaries, but an idea, then you're really able to find the creative inspiration, and I don't know, you're able to find the songs easier. You know, anytime you kind of set up a creative playground, it just becomes easier, because everything, you can do anything. If you can write about anything, there's limitless possibilities. And so to sort of set up a mission statement like that early on was really helpful for us. And then it enabled us to borrow from songs, and I feel like I'm rambling now, but yes.
I think that when you're making a solo record, there's less of a necessity to like have a mission statement, because if the source material is largely coming from you, your singular brain and your skills, your specific skills, there's going to be, in all likelihood, a way that the album relates to itself, because you might be dealing with like one of three. I know personally, on a solo record, I might be sourcing like four major things in my life that I've been processing, and those things will come out in the songs, and ideally they'll relate to each other, just simply because of the original source in my life. But when you're collaborating with a group of people, you know, it can get scattered unless there's a unifying concept or dream of what the intent is. And so I think it makes a lot of sense to have these kinds of conversations where we where we're saying, you know, let's take this from this song. This relates here in this other way. And in a way of also saying like how these songs relate to each other is how, you know, people relate to each other. There's a lot of overlapping themes in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, a lot of what we've talked about in context with this new album is about the lyrical content and about the themes. But, you know, musically, there's also this, there's a daring nature to the way the chord progressions play themselves out. There are all these unexpected melodic moments. And I had this feeling upon listening to it. I've only had it a couple other times. I remember going to see Radiohead live and going to see Prince live. And I remember having this feeling, these people are not just counting to four over and over again like I do. there's something else happening. It's not, you know, you're not just laying out, these are the four chords and this is the easy place to go. And anyone who's a Nickel Creek fan is already coming to you guys expecting virtuosity. I mean, that's a part of what you guys do. But I think there's also a case to be made for, there's a real respect that you show your audience when you say, I think they can handle this. I think people can handle chord progressions and melodies that are going to take them outside of just maybe the primary colors that they're used to in pop music. Mm-hmm. You know, you're already having, you have three creative personalities together writing the songs. To what degree does the audience play a role in as you're putting these songs together?
It's fun. I mean, you need to consider the audience is part of the band. You know, or you should just do it in your room for yourself. Right. If you're going to put them out there, then you need to consider them, but you need to be, mindful of how you're considering them and for what purpose, to what end, like how you're considering them and to what end, and being careful to, if you're sitting there going like, you know, what can we do to make the most amount of people dig our stuff? That's not like a sincere place for me to hang out in. I'm not personally interested in music that where I detect that as one of the primary movers. It doesn't get me going. But that doesn't mean that you're sitting there giving the double bird to the audience either, you know? Cause again, it's like, I love playing music for people. I I think this band, there's always been a part of this band that's about good vibes in a big room. But that also doesn't mean that you need to spoon feed people music or admit defeat, like as a species that we can't handle more than like diatonic harmony and simple fractions, I refuse to believe that humanity is done evolving as music, a music making force, and so I think you have to There's a certain amount of head in the sand in that regard. Yeah, I mean, if you listen to the radio, there's not much out there that's going to challenge you as a music lover. Yeah. You know, it's mostly like petting you on the head and telling you that you're doing a good job.
Yeah.
For me, that just makes me feel like dying. So I don't want to engage in that.
It's like, it's less like, here's a spoonful of sugar with the medicine. It's more just like, here's a spoonful of sugar.
Yeah.
When you listen to the radio, which can be great, you know, I love pop music, and they're, you know, but I think I would say also, it's an interesting question because of the time that we were writing it, which was, you know, we started February 18th or 19th, of 2021. Pre-vaccine, pre-anything happening again, we were thinking very much about how much we wanted to play these songs and how much we were excited to play these songs as we were writing them. And as they were coming to shape and we were seeing them, like what they're going to be, we got very excited about playing them for people. And, you know, so It was less like, are they going to like it? And more like, oh my gosh, we can't wait to like, you know, and even getting way ahead of ourselves. Like, what if we start our set with, you know, like Celebrants, a song, like when it was half written, there were conversations that we could start a set with this, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that kind of like getting ahead of ourselves is sort of a really joyful feeling. And, I think it's just
it can help you write as well. Mm-hmm. Cause it, you know, anything to help you chip away at the block of marble and help you imagine something collectively more clearly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if the three of us can put ourselves in that place that we know, okay, here's like a little imaginary playpen that we can all picture very, very distinctly. So it's like us at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, put ourselves there. What's going to feel good? What's going to feel good to play? Not what's going to get us to, you know, Madison Square Garden from the Ryman Auditorium. Not that, but what's going to feel good to play in these places that we know we're going to be in? You know, and so, and you know, what feels good is again, not just what is, you know, a warm bath, but also what's going to feel good and challenging. And when we're done with it, you know, give you that pleasantly exhausted feeling.
Because I think that also mirrors everything where we are in life. And I think our audience feels that as well. You know, this pleasant but exhausting era where many have are in, you know, relationships or have children, and that is it's complicated, and life does seem quite simple when you're younger, but as we age and as our parents age and as our kids age, everything is complicated and nuanced and dissonant and also joyful. And I think that all of those things are what we're living right now and what we're feeling right now, and also what our audience is going through as well. Our audience is us in a lot of ways. We've played for some of these people since we were all, you know, 17, 18 years old.
Yeah.
And we've lived life alongside them to a great extent. And we're incredibly lucky to have an audience that still will continue to stay on this journey with us, you know?
Yeah.
It's been very rewarding to play this new material for people who are excited to know it and excited to be there with us after so long being with us on, you know, with the previous, four records.
So I want to ask you, Sarah, you know, I listened to a song like Where the Long Line Leads when I was a kid, I had a speech impediment and I couldn't say L's. That would have been like my nightmare, Where the Long Line Leads. That that sounds like one of the exercises I used to have to do as a kid with my speech therapist.
Anyway, come a long way, baby.
But I listened to a song like Where the Long Line Leads, and it's like this, it's up tempo, and you know, it's more of this kind of barn burner type of thing. Pretty surely I can feel what they think, pieces that they felt. You've got an album where there's a lot of reflective songs. I mean, you guys are getting into some like real life stuff, deep stuff. And is there a sense when you're kind of getting together to write a record where you go, hey, you know what? We need to do like a rowdy one here. Like just to, in terms of varying, I mean, is there an intentionality to when you write a song like that, that says, hey, we see where a lot of these songs are kind of going. Let's provide a kind of a counterbalance to some of it.
I think there's an awareness of that. There's also just an instinct to want to hear it when we're writing as you know, Sean and Chris were talking about, like, building a lot of these from the ground up, these songs alongside each other. And so as listeners, we just naturally want to hear something that we're not hearing yet, you know? So yeah. if we have a selection of songs that makes us, in addition to those songs, want to hear something that's a bit of a party, yeah, and like just kind of like a relentless good time.
Yeah.
We want to hear that because of what we've already had. And, sure. So I think some of the balance comes from a natural, it comes from like a natural place, an instinctual place, much more so than like a strategy place.
Yeah.
I think it's all, it first comes, there is that, of course, like some strategy and especially when we talk about sequence and all that, but all of that is based on what we want to feel and what we are not yet feeling. So let's make it happen so that we're feeling that, you know, we get to build it.
Yeah.
And,
it's like
that's
being
a particularly
chef.
Fun one. Yeah.
It's like being a chef, you know, it's like you can't have all lemon juice. You can't have all salt. you know, you need to make sure that the dish is balanced.
Yeah.
You know, slow isn't slow without fast, and fast isn't fast without slow. It's a thing that's always strange to me about listening to death metal or something like that. I get very desensitized to it, like yeah, almost instantaneously.
Right.
You just accept that.
Yeah. If everybody's TSA pre-check, nobody's TSA pre-check.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Hey, Songcraft listeners, we're taking a quick break from our conversation with Nickel Creek to tell you about an exciting company that we just recently learned about called Stubforge. Now, let me explain what this is, because it maybe is the coolest company I've ever heard of. I feel like they made this just for me. I am a guy who has collected my concert ticket stubs my entire life, from the time I was a kid up until just a few years ago, when basically you couldn't get physical tickets anymore. Everything became a QR code. Everything became digital. I had saved all of these tickets from my entire life, and then my collection just stops. Well, my life didn't end, so I want to keep adding to this collection. What they do at Stubforge is they will take the information from any show that you attended, whether that be a concert or a sporting event, and they will create a ticket that looks just like a legit Ticketmaster ticket, printed on that same stock of paper, has that exact same look and design. In fact, they have multiple designs from the different types of designs that Ticketmaster has used over the years, and you can create tickets to just slot in and fill those spaces in your collection. Maybe it's a show you went to 30 years ago and you wish you'd kept the ticket stub. Or maybe it's something you've just been to in the last few years that you didn't even have the opportunity to get a stub for. I know that I've been making a list of things I'm planning to order ASAP.
Yeah, you and I spent some time on the website today, and just looking at it, I'm doing the same thing. I'm like, oh man, I'm missing a ticket from that. I'm missing a ticket from that. I can get one here now. And you don't realize something is iconic until it's gone.
Right.
You know, those tickets themselves, I don't think they seemed like a big deal to us until you couldn't get them anymore.
Right, right. Yeah. And the thing that's so cool about this is that, you know, if you've given somebody, like I've given my wife tickets to events for like a birthday gift or something like that, it's awkward to be like, well, your gift is coming in your Ticketmaster app. I'm transferring it to you.
I printed the email and folded it up.
If you're giving somebody tickets as a gift, you can now print actual physical tickets so that you can wrap them up in a box and you can see their face light up when they open it and look at it. Then later you can transfer them that QR code or whatever, but they get to actually see and grasp what the gift is. Not only that, you can use their templates to do like party invitations.
That's amazing.
You could do wedding invitations, you know, as like a retro Ticketmaster ticket, which is super cool. You know, baby showers or barbecues, anniversaries, any kind of gathering that you're having, you want to invite people to. This is just super cool. We're really excited about this. We don't do a lot of ads on Songcraft because we only do ads about things that we believe in. And we think this is amazing. So go to stubforge.com and check out their various templates and all the different things you can do with it. We're already tripping over ourselves with excitement to order some of these. And we know you guys are going to love it. You all grew up together. I mean, obviously, Sean and Sarah, your siblings, but all three of you grew up together. You know, Chris mentioned earlier that you guys have been a band for 34 years. I don't know if there's any band that has been together 34 years that are not yet AARP eligible. Like, you guys are still, you know, it's so that doing the math, you've been in a band together since you were just children, really. And
yeah, I think the trick is to start when you're 8 and 12.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I look at the very beginning. I understand, Sarah, that Byron Berline was your fiddle teacher, and he's a guy who was winning traditional fiddle championships, but also playing with the Rolling Stones and playing with the Flying Burrito Brothers and being extraordinarily competent in two very different musical worlds. And I look at that as kind of where you guys started. And here you are writing an album with Mike Elizondo, who, you know, is such a diverse musician and producer. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's credited as a co-writer on Into Club by 50 Cent and yep. Slim Shady, you know, with Eminem, and has, but also Carrie Underwood. Like, that's a guy who just is super competent in a lot of genres. And when I listen to what you guys do, obviously you came out of traditional bluegrass, but by your second album, you're covering a Pavement song. And the stuff that you guys have been doing for years is certainly like well beyond the confines of bluegrass. You're pulling from all sorts of sources, but it doesn't sound like you're dabbling in those. You're like true musical omnivores. Like, you guys obviously embrace a lot of different music and have surrounded yourselves with people who are also musical omnivores, from Byron to Mike and tons in between that we could mention. And I think in all that, my question is kind of when that developed. Like, when you guys were kids, was it just sort of like all bluegrass all the time? And then as you got older, you started getting into all this new stuff? Or were you guys like soaking up just all kinds of influences from the time that you were really young, and bluegrass was just one of those things?
The thing that everyone says where you listen to the music your parents were playing, you know, that's true. And so that was a pretty good range. But the bluegrass band that we grew up seeing a lot, Bluegrass Etc., played traditional instrumentation, but it wasn't as strict of a bluegrass.
Hey, it's in the title.
Yeah.
Emphasis on the et cetera. And they, you know, they were playing Flying Burrito Brothers and Beach Boys and Beatles songs and Birds, and also, you know, some like Vince Gill and like 80s country, and as well as bluegrass stuff. And so I think there was always this idea of like, you can play anything on these instruments. And then also, you know, your worlds expand as you grow up and you start listening to the stuff your friends are listening to when you go to school, and it's an ever expanding world of music. And when ingested fully, it can come out in a really natural way. So you're not just like taking a reference point of somebody else's music and pasting it onto your song, you know. Ideally, we take the time to really ingest the things that affect us in a way that we can metabolize them in a true way, and they'll make their way into our expression at some point.
Yeah, I think it was we were musical omnivores. But it was mostly acoustic folk, and classical, you know, at least for me and Sarah, maybe, a lot of, you know, our parents listened to the record collection was like classical, Celtic, folk, and then like, you know, Dylan and the Band and Beach Boys. But then once we got into bluegrass, it was just kind of like the range of music that was presented to us was so wide, and we didn't even really realize, you know, that it was that wide, you know, going to see this band every Saturday night, until later. And like, I remember going to like IBMA, which is the International Bluegrass Music Association. And they have a week long, they still do it. It's a week long conference, and there's showcases, and then there's a festival at the end. And we went to it for the first time. It was in Owensboro, Kentucky, and at a hotel. And you realize that there's a whole area of, you know, what traditional bluegrass really is, and how it's presented, and, you know, how people even dress, you know, and they wear suits. And there are a lot of people who you know, every kind of every form of music has a traditionalist sect, and we kind of realize that there is a pretty hardcore sect of people who really believe bluegrass should not be messed with, and we were these little kids messing with it, not because we wanted to, but just that was just how it was presented to us. It's like this is an open playing field, anything's possible, and I feel, you know, really, really grateful because I mean, you know, the musically, the stuff that they were doing, the songs that they were doing, that band, it's not necessarily sonically what we are at all, you know, anymore, but the idea and the open-mindedness of it really made an impression on us that I don't think I fully realized until much, much later on.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to ask you guys, I feel like I could talk about the philosophical concepts with you guys all day because I love hearing about the way you approach it from a kind of a macro standpoint. But I want to get into the micro of songwriting just a little bit. Like I would imagine, you know, a song like Doubting Thomas, you're looking at a very personal song, which is, you know, those songs you write by yourself, you know, it's either you're writing snippets of lyrics, you're coming to it, you know, or you're writing it in one sitting. I'm curious about this, the three of you writing together process, with instruments in hands. I mean, who leads the way? And at what point do you say, no, we're changing chords here? Especially when you get to these songs on the new record that are so, you know, it's not like you can just wink and go, we're obviously going to the five chord here. I mean,
right.
I'd love to know just a little bit about the step-by-step process of writing these songs in particular.
Wild and messy and beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. It's different for each one. You know, so it would be probably best to think about just in terms like a, is there any particular one want us to walk you through?
I'd like to talk about Goddamn Saint.
Great.
Because I think it's a great song. And I also think there's probably maybe a thread to draw between that and Doubting Thomas, but that's for another question. But yeah, let's talk about Goddamn Saint. Let's talk about how that song was written just on a specific level.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I had this tiny little snippet of really just that opening, the da 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 da, and it, you know, it has a little bit of interesting harmony right from the start. So I showed Sarah and Sean that to the point where we could get a vibe going on it. I was like, I think it's kind of a downstrokey thing, and you know, again, it's like a 20-second snippet of music, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we got a vibe on it. And Sarah, we were in this big, beautiful, room. This house, the house that is like a vacation house of a friend of ours that we got to stay in with our families and work on this stuff. And the big common room, it's huge. It sounds gorgeous. Sounds like it's a freaking cathedral. And Sarah started singing the melody an octave higher than me, which is real high. And if you want to hear what it sounds like, it's right towards the end of the song. And we, you know, we all heard that sound and went, okay, this, you know, how comedians sit around and go, hey, is this something? Is this something? You know, about their bits.
Yeah. Is this a thing?
Yeah. And honestly, that's what we do a ton, especially when we're writing together. Is this something? Is this something? And when we heard that texture, so Sean and me just thrashing on downstrokes, and then Sarah and me singing this really swooping melody in octaves, we knew we had something, and we knew it was worth getting on. And then the kind of grandeur of that texture in that space then suggested the kind of rangy subject matter.
Yeah.
And then also like the sort of, you know, existentialist topic. and you know, and particularly talking about worldviews colliding and people engaging in that sort of, interaction in good faith, and with open ears and allowing for the chance that the person, you know, the person across the table for them might be able to change their mind about something. Mm-hmm. And which is, you know, it's just a very rare and beautiful thing, especially in today's world. And so that's how that starts. And then you just go to work and you think about, okay, so what's a, that song that's, so we had that start. We knew it was cool. We all liked it. I had an idea about what the subject matter could be. Sarah and Sean got into it.
We all actually lived it.
Yeah.
Together, like simultaneously, the source material. So it was that was nice as well. It was.
So then we can kind of keep each other honest as the lyrical ideas start flowing, and like, this aspect of it doesn't seem sincere or seems overwrought, or it kind of clouds the matter, or what are you getting at here? That kind of thing.
And
I think everybody can understand how that would work lyrically. And then just sort of superimpose that sort of idea into the musical realm where, and that's as you're searching for non-diatonic harmonic moves, you know, or like a shifting tonal center.
Yeah.
Like Goddamn Saint has, you know, you're doing the same thing. Does this feel sincere? Like that's what's so wonderful about having collaborators that you respect, is that you're constantly able to bounce things off of each other, suggest a thing, someone mishears it in a way that makes it better. You know, is it, do you mean this? And you didn't mean that, but what they're playing you is better than what you meant. You know, that's the process you're going through.
Is this a song about an actual person that you guys all know?
Mm-hmm.
Indeed it is.
Yeah. Somebody who actually, you know, it from Santa Barbara, where we were writing. But it also, I think this song lyrically really encapsulates one of, you know, we were talking about our sort of mission statement at the beginning, which was the, you know, inherent friction in any meaningful relationship. You know, the lyrics really, really talk about that, because it was all friendly and good friction, but it was, you know, we were meeting this person and having these conversations that were challenging to us. And, you know, coming from a churchy religious upbringing, and you know, where there normally would have been, where there could have been the sparks or arguing, there wasn't, because he was just listening and taking it in without judging it. And we didn't know it at the time. I mean, literally, you just read the lyric is just such a through form story of exactly what happened, literally. But the impact that he made on us by listening and not judging, was pretty profound, and something again that I don't think we realized until later on in life.
how rare that is.
Yeah. And the fact that we, you know, we were trying to kind of, I think at that time, sort of convince him of some things that we thought and believed. And by him just listening and talking to us and not taking offense to any of it, or it really opened us up to new things. And so that last line, we can only change someone as much as we're willing to be changed. You know, that's like the thesis of the whole song, and something that we have talked about, as the three of us, just in conversations, before making this record. I remember Chris saying, maybe it was just during that.
Yeah. I said that was in a conversation, early on in Santa Barbara. And so that lyric, I knew that was where we were headed. So whatever happened to the song, that was going to be the last part of the song. And so it's nice to know what you're shooting for.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the landing. That was the place where we wanted to land.
With anyone who disagrees,
And it's always nice when you have that kind of a thing, a landing point, because it's really something to shoot for and shape the song around.
Yeah,
I like how that song talks about what it talks about, without it, because it was an actual thing that happened to us, and it's a story. It's not. There's not a you should at all in that song. It's not like a preach. It's not preachy in any way. And I think it would be hard to imagine how to get that sentiment across without it being preachy, if it wasn't an example of how it had been done, you know?
Well, so, you know, in terms of this most recent record, obviously we know how you guys put it together. You all came together and wrote together. In the early days, you know, we didn't see any of your original song, Sarah, until the third record. And on the first couple records, we saw mixes of, you know, some covers and some original songs and really like writing separately. And I noted, I don't know if this was intentional, but on the first record, Chris, you wrote two songs solo and two in collaboration. Sean, you wrote two songs solo and two in collaboration. Then there's like two cover songs and two traditional songs. It's like perfectly symmetrical. Weird. Was that like a negotiated thing at the time? Like, was there a point where you kind of go like, well, hey, look, we all need to kind of like make sure that this is equal and fair. Was that part of the process of figuring out how song contributions would work as a band, or was that just kind of how it happened?
I don't remember it being discussed, but maybe it was subconsciously in there. I don't know.
I mean, I think in general, you want a band to be, you know, well represented. You want an album to be well represented, but the people are in it. But there was never any real discussion about it. And especially for the first two albums that Allison produced, it was just about what's the best song? What's the best version of this?
Yeah.
And of this album, of this song. And she was pretty just ruthless about that in a great way. Like, you know, for instance, Reasons Why was a song that I wrote or co-wrote. And we'd made the demo of it with me singing, or I'd made a demo of it. And she was like, this is a great song. I think it's great, but Sarah should sing it, you know? And I probably felt like a little let down, but not really, because I was just excited to be making a record with Allison.
Yeah.
And see that process happening. But it's funny. I've never thought about it, what you just said, in terms of how it was represented in terms of covers and things like that. I had never even thought about that. Or
yeah,
the covers largely were just because I mean a lot of them anyway, because I didn't really start writing until I was in my 20s,
right?
So a lot of it was just to get songs that I could sing. I would just find covers.
Yeah.
Or steal Sean's songs, as you just heard.
Right
But I think now it's more just because the band sounds the best if everybody's perspectives are being, you know, represented or considered, and it just makes the material feel more comprehensive.
Yeah,
more transcendent. It's
right.
You know, you're always looking for transcendence as someone who makes things,
mm-hmm.
and collaboration mm-hmm. is the surest fire way. You know, legitimate collaboration is the easiest way to achieve transcendence. Like,
yeah.
If you're actually able to adopt someone else's perspective,
yeah.
to the point that you can create with them within that perspective. It's just like, I live for that shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I think of like a song like Destination, which is a song that all three of you guys wrote together on the fourth record and is your second most streamed song on Spotify. So obviously very popular with the fans. three of you kind of get together as collaborators, there's something about it that's magic. Like you say, Chris, you function kind of best working in that collaboration. I'm curious, when you guys started doing that, was there a rocky road to it in terms of, okay, well, we've played together since we were kids, but now we're all intentionally writing together? Were there growing pains in terms of how to do that successfully together, or was it something that was just natural because of the relationships that existed?
I think it can be both, right? I'm thinking about, like, the first time we really tried to write together was for Why Should the Fire Die? Mm-hmm. And that was somewhat successful in terms of, like, actual collaboration, but it was difficult. I think at that point, still, the person singing the song had far and away, you know, would take the charge. And then maybe the other two would be editing, which, you know, is not a terrible way to do it. But I think we were definitely learning how to do it on Why Should the Fire Die? And that was is a record we're really proud of. But I think we were learning how to do it better now. It feels...
Well, these are the first... Those songs were still... We still weren't actually writing with each other that much in a room. You know, we did it a little bit at Sean's place. Remember on the beach? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think one of the more successful... you know, we did Best of Luck that way, but we don't love that song.
Right.
And we did the first fruits of, like, really being in the room writing together with a successful result is the actual song Why Should the Fire Die?
Yeah.
I think that really shows the potential that I think that song shows the potential of us as like in the room co-writers as opposed to in the room editors of people's starts. And then, you know, Dotted Line, we did a little bit of that. And this record is the real, this is really it coming to fruition. And, you know, for us all to be in our 40s and have gotten a lot of, you know, we've gotten to say what we need to say. Not that we're done saying what we need to say, but we've gotten a lot of time to say what we want to say as individuals. And so when we get into the room together, I'm really, really interested in what happens when the three of us are bouncing off each other in a way that in my 20s, I was still much more interested in what happens when I bounce off of people,
right.
You know, and like, here's my shit. What do y'all think?
Yeah.
I don't actually care that much. Here's some,
like,
more
there's
of
no
it.
Reason for me to write a song and be like, hey, Sean and Chris, play this song that I wrote. Like, that, there's no reason to do that. And it's way more interesting to do it together and see what happens there. And it's also rarer. Like, we, you know, come together for a time to write a record, and that's kind of a precious time to have set aside for this express purpose, to be together and to do this thing that we don't get to do unless we, like, plan ahead and make some flights and book a place to be.
Yeah.
Like, it we want to do it when we're together. That's what we really want to do. And anymore, there's no real reason to do a solo thing without, you know, a lot of input from the bandmates.
Yeah.
Yep. I've been writing lately. I've just been having little ideas here and there. You know, it kind of comes in waves for me, my creativity. I sort of have these, you know, ebbs and flows. And for whatever reason, I've just lately, like every other day, have a little song start. And the other day I had some time. I had a couple hours free while our 2-year-old was sleeping. And I just kind of started diving in on, you know, on one of these ideas and writing it. And I was just like, you know, writing by yourself is it's fine. It's fun. It's great. But I found myself thinking, like, man, I wish Sarah and Chris were here. Like, what would they? I'm literally thinking, like, what would they think if I played, like, 4 a chord progression and a melody, and I, you know, playing guitar, singing melody, and I found myself going, what would they think? What would they do? What would they suggest? You know, just kind of like, that's where my mind went, and yeah, it's just way more fun and exciting, but again, also we're always going to be writing, doing our individual things and working on, you know, solo projects and things like that. So there's a time and place for everything, but this particular way of writing is just really exciting and fun and, you know, verdant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thank you so much for speaking with us today. The most recent record is called Celebrants. It's fantastic. We want to encourage our listeners to check that out. And it's just been really great to hear about you guys, your process of writing together. And thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for talking with us.
That was a joy.
Thanks for listening. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can keep up with us on Instagram at Songcraft Conversations or Facebook at Songcraft Show. To join our team and help support our content, become a Songcraft patron at patreon.com. Visit patreon.com/songcraftshow.
And you can always find us at songcraftshow.com.